This is WNUT Talk on the WNUT Radio Network. Hey, it's Brandon on WNUT Talk. You are listening to WNUT on the Live 365 Network. If you're not, if you're maybe catching this somewhere else on a podcast or on YouTube or somewhere like that, you really ought to go and download the Live 365 app or just search on live365.com for WNUT. We will come right up. I have a pretty interesting one today to talk about, and it is the time that Prince, some might say, lost his mind and changed his entire name to a symbol. Just decided, I don't want to have a name that people can pronounce anymore. You know, language and letters are too much of a burden for me to bear. I want to have a name that no one can pronounce because it's a picture. That's something that really happened. And if you weren't there for it in the 90s, I will take you there. I will explain what that shit was like. As best we can imagine it from his perspective, but also from the perspective of the people who were just watching it happen. Maybe people who loved Prince and his music and had listened to him for years, or maybe people who weren't really that familiar with him and just watched this guy apparently deteriorate into madness. But there was a method, it turned out, behind his madness. We will get into that in a little bit. Again, like I said, my name is Brandon, also sometimes known as Stony. Depending on what episode of WNUT you're listening to, or possibly how far back you go with WNUT, one and the same. If you missed the last, actually the premiere episode of WNUT Talk, I sat here and pontificated, I'll say, for close to 45 minutes, if not 45 minutes, about physical media and record stores, what is so magical about them, why the search and the hunt is almost as exciting as listening to the music that you find. Why that is such a time-honored tradition, to fall back on a cliche, and what you're missing if you're not a part of that subculture, or if you've gotten out of collecting, or if you maybe, you know, never were a part of collecting, and you just like to stream music. Maybe you came up in the MP3 era. Let me tell you, go back and check that episode out, because I've got some really cool thoughts on it. I've got some cool history about it. I've got some cool takes on everything regarding physical media and the music stores that are still out there, the record stores that still have stacks and stacks of that stuff for you to explore and check out and discover. But today, the topic is Prince. And let me take you back to a very young Brandon, a very young Stony. I'll talk to you about how I came to know Prince, how he and I met. Not literally, because, you know, I was probably three at the time. But Delirious from the 1999 album was just tearing up the charts in late 83, early 84. You would hear that song pretty regularly on pop radio. And I, as a young and budding music fan, I was learning what I liked in music by just listening to the stuff that played on the radio in my mom's car. And I would respond to it, you know, favorably or unfavorably, I guess. And the things that I really liked, she would go out and buy the 45 RPM single of that song. And at a very, very young age, God, I would have to ask her to be sure, but I think it was probably around the time I was three or four, I knew how to operate a record player. And I would take these things, I would put them on, and I would listen to the songs that I really liked and that she wound up buying for me at my convenience. And so Delirious wound up being one of them. I fell in love with that song. It was so energetic. It was just, if you haven't heard Delirious, check it out. It's actually, it's a 12-bar blues, but you'd never know. It's like synth-laden pop, and it cleverly disguises the 12-bar blues aspect of that song. Soon, I would have a run-in with the Purple Rain album. Let me explain that. I loved Michael Jackson's Thriller. Holy Lord, nothing was better to me than the song Beat It when I was a kid. I'd walk around with a little portable cassette player and just Beat It would be blaring from that thing at all hours that I was awake of the day. Until one day, my dad went to a party. I think my parents went to a party together. My dad took my copy of Thriller on cassette. I was never going to know by the time I woke up the next morning. Thriller would be safely back, you know, in my small and growing collection of music. Well, he grabbed the wrong tape when he left the party. And what he brought home was Purple Rain. And when I woke up and Thriller wasn't there and I couldn't put Beat It on and walk around the house with that blaring, the world was no longer a kind place. I was very unhappy. I was a pissed off little kid. Purple Rain was not going to cut it. And I was like, we got to make this right. And he was like, well, I can't go back to these people's house. I don't even know that he knew the people having the party. It was probably somebody, you know, through a friend of, but anyway, he couldn't go get the tape, you know. You have no idea what an emergency this was to me at that age. So he had to run out and get me a new copy of Thriller. And to this day, I've kind of forgiven Purple Rain. I finally bought it on CD a few years ago. But there's still a part of me deep down inside that doesn't like Purple Rain for that reason. And then Prince wound up doing the soundtrack to the Batman movie. And my God, man, like that's one of my top three favorite films of all time. The 1989 Batman with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. Prince could have bent over and farted into the mic for 10 or 12 tracks, and I would have thought it was genius, and I would have loved it if it were the Batman soundtrack. Wouldn't have cared. So from that day forward, Prince was just going to be A-okay with me. And, you know, he went on to do the Love Symbol album, which we'll talk about, with Seven, which was a huge favorite of mine in 92, 93. But before I get into that, did you know, if you live in the Augusta, Georgia, the Richmond, Virginia, or the Sacramento, California areas, if you live in any one of those three places, you may be familiar with the TV news anchor and reporter named Chris Thomas. Chris Thomas can do an incredible Prince impression. I know this because when I was a photographer and I shot his news pieces every day, we'd go out in the field together. I would get the video and he'd write the stories and we would put the shit together. I'm listening to Prince in the news Jeep in like 2007 or 8. Chris starts doing a Prince impression that blew me the fuck away. I was so impressed. And I would bug him repeatedly for years to come to do that again. I think he only did it once. He was so shy. But if you know of Chris Thomas, if you've seen him on TV, I want you to know the next time you see that man's face on your local newscast, he can do an incredible Prince impression. But anyway, If you don't know kind of the backstory of Prince, quickly I'll tell you. Prince signed his first record contract with Warner Brothers Records in 1977 when he was still a teenager. And his debut album came out the following year in 1978. And so for 15 years, he delivered an album a year to the fine folks at Warner Brothers. I mean, like clockwork. Every year there was going to be a new Prince album. Every year, I mean, the shit would tear the charts up. Warner's began to worry, though, by the early 90s, that such a consistent and, shall we say, voluminous, a prolific output from one of their biggest names would kind of oversaturate the public a little bit. When asked about this after Prince's death in 2016, a Warner executive who had worked with him throughout his career named Mary Lou Beto said, "I would tell him that it was counterproductive, that people can only absorb so much music from one artist at a time." That's what she had to say. And it sounds like Prince just didn't want to hear it. Like, he wanted to put the music out when it was ready. He didn't care if it came in batches of 12, if it came in batches of 100. If he had 12 songs or 50, he wanted to put them out when they came. You know what I'm saying? And Warner's was not going to play that game. So he started to feel a little stifled by the new deal that he signed with Warner Brothers in the early 90s. And furthermore, he started to feel a little exploited and maybe a little trapped because the record label had even trademarked his name, Prince. Prince was not a stage name. That was his given name. His first name was Prince. His name was Prince Rogers Nelson. They trademarked his name. They marketed him with his actual name, which was partly their property now. He felt like a commodity. As he moved into the 90s, he felt trapped by kind of not being able to dictate what and when he put out music-wise, and he started to feel kind of like a dancing toy, you know, at the service of Warner Brothers. Whenever the label pulled the string, he was going to do his little thing. So Prince had an idea, and it was a bit of a strange one. In 1992, his staff approached the design firm HDMG about coming up with a symbol that combined Mars, or men, and Venus, or women, into one concept. You've seen these symbols. There's the little circle with kind of the arrow coming out of the top right and that represents Mars or men. Venus is the circle with kind of the cross coming out of the bottom. He wanted to sort of put these things together, and he had played with the concept a little bit on the cover of Graffiti Bridge already, but he wanted to take it a step further, and he wanted something that was kind of his own. He wanted somebody to come up with that, and he kind of wanted it quickly. So HDMG, assuming that he wanted it for an album cover or something like that, a single or God knows what, maybe Banners on Tour, you know, they weren't sure. So employees Mitch Monson and Liz Luce came up with a few concepts. They showed these concepts to Prince. He picked one that he liked, and that one would make history. Trademarked as Love Symbol Number 2, that symbol would not only adorn the cover of his new album released in October 1992, but it would be the actual title. That's right. He named his album a picture. He named it a drawing. He named the album for something you couldn't say. There was no, the symbol didn't have a word associated with it. It's not like the symbol meant, you know, happiness, and then you could call the album Happiness. It didn't work that way. The symbol itself, the drawing, was the name of the album. And people would say, well, how do you want us to refer to the album? Well, it's the symbol. There was no answer. And that was kind of frustrating to MTV and media. The Warner Brothers actually had to distribute that symbol as kind of a font element that MTV could load into their Chyron, which is the thing that puts words on the screen. And MTV could show that symbol at the beginning and end of the music videos they played from it. You know, when they would identify to you the artist, the name of the track, the album, and the record label, they needed to be able to put a damn symbol on there. And so Warner Brothers had to supply him with that. This was an odd move. I used to like kind of fucking with the guys that worked at music stores by walking in, asking them, do you have the new Prince album? And they'd say, well, what's the name of it? And I would take my finger and draw a symbol in the air, and they would look at me like I'd lost my mind. And I thought that was hilarious. But anyway, I was 12 or 13. It was hilarious to me. Still is, in fact. To be fair, this album was massive. It didn't need a title, apparently. It hit number 5 on the Billboard 200. It spawned at least 4 singles in the Hot 100, the most successful of which, titled 7, peaked at, you guessed it, number 7 on the Billboard chart on February 27th, 1993. I have it right here. I did my research. But things would only get weirder from there. For an album that started with another top 40 single called My Name is Prince, this album would notably be one of the last to have his name on it until the century was over. More on that when we come back right after this.
Full episodes at 6, noon, and 8. After Dark, Saturday nights at 10. WNUT.
You are listening to WNUT Talk. We are talking about Prince today. We're talking about the love symbol. We're talking about, you might call it a musical midlife crisis that he had. That happened in the early 90s. We were just discussing the album that came out in 1992 that was titled The Symbol, that he had the HDMG marketing people come up with. And the symbol, the one thing about it was, if you look at it, it's not a symmetrical symbol. The spiral on the left side of it is not perfect. The crossbar that runs through it is kind of a little disproportional on one side. Apparently he wanted it that way. According to the folks at HDMG, he asked for them to make it kind of off balance because he wanted it to represent the human body, reportedly, or to represent ideas that are often in conflict, like man versus woman, or sex versus religion, and so on, things like that. With Prince, it's hard to know the extent of the thought process. It's kind of like what goes on in that mind. We would need a team of people to really, kind of piece some of these things together through the years. And there'd be a lot to consider to arrive at that point. But so while we might not see the name Prince very often for several years to come, and I'll get to that in a moment, one name that we would be seeing a lot more of was the New Power Generation. Because when Prince played at Rock in Rio 2 in January 1991, a new backing band debuted with him, named after a song from his 1990 album, Graffiti Bridge. The New Power Generation. The New Power Generation was a beast of a band. If you're not familiar with Prince's work around that time, I encourage you to listen to anything, starting with Diamonds and Pearls. The Love Symbol album is a great example songs like Sexy MF, for God's sake. This band was sharp as a knife, and they were masters of funk and rock and jazz and dance and R&B and soul. And that's just to name a few. There was nothing they couldn't do. I remember being very impressed by their range, you know, as a young teenager. This band made impact when they played. And they'd be with him for the rest of his life in one form or another. With the exception being in 2014, he had a band called Third Eye Girl that backed him on the Plectrum Electrum album. With that exception, it was a new power generation. In one form or another, the NPG was there until he died. And even after he died, the new power generation reunited and did a few Prince tribute tours, before hanging it up in 2019. And who knows? I mean, we could see him again. They've actually popped up in some interesting places. We'll get to that in a little while as well. But while the membership would ebb and flow a bit, the prime version of this band, the best incarnation, the one that matters, arguably lasted until about 96, or through the recording of the Gold Experience album and tour. They released three albums under the group's name, actually, not just backing Prince on his releases, but they actually put some albums out as the New Power Generation, the first of which I can't even say, because it rhymes with Gold Digga, and it came out in 1993. The second was called Exodus. That was released in 1995. And that brings us to the third. But before we get there, the original incarnation of the band seems to have split around 96. Like I said, after they did the Gold Experience and the tour, they kind of went their separate ways. One member even took some legal action against Prince for royalties that he claimed the singer still owed him. And no shit, wouldn't you know it, but the core of the original band got back together in 2010. Keyboardist Tommy Barbarella, drummer Michael Bland, and bass player Sonny T joined, of all people, Nick Jonas and the Administration. So the New Power Generation reunited behind Nick Jonas in 2010. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Back in 1992, let's not worry about the New Power Generation right now. Prince is riding high. He's got a new band. He's got a new symbol that totally belongs to him. His album is just tearing it up, you know, on the Billboard charts and on radio and MTV. But he's in a contract that he hates. His name is trademarked by the record label, and he just wants the freedom to do musically whatever he wants. So what does he do? On his 35th birthday, June 7th, 1993, Prince announces that he will no longer go by Prince. He's changing his professional name to the love symbol which had adorned his last album. And again, I want to make it clear. That is not a symbol that means, okay, if I see this symbol, say the word happiness. People call it the love symbol album because they, you know, it's come out that it's trademarked as love symbol number two. But when you see that symbol, he didn't put it there. He didn't design it for you to then just say the words love symbol. He wanted you not to be able to pronounce the goddamn thing. He wanted there not to be something that symbol translated to that was easy to just say or refer to. He wanted it to transcend that. He wanted it to be more than that. So no, if I or you refer to the love symbol album, we're just finding a way to identify it so that other people are going to know what we're saying. But you're not supposed to, that's not the official name. That's not the actual name of that album. The actual name of that album is the picture that you cannot pronounce. So I just want to make it clear that now he's named this thing that has no word associated with it. You can't say the love symbol artist or the love symbol singer. How the fuck are you supposed to refer to him? Now, he didn't change his name legally, mind you. People often tell this story as if he went down to the Minnesota probate court and just changed his birth name to that thing. And he didn't do that. This was a professional move. But now the label had a problem. You remember all that shit that I just said a second ago? Frantically trying to make it clear that you can't pronounce this thing, and that there's not just a word that goes. That's what the label was facing. How do we market him? How do we promote an artist without a name? What do we even call him? Well, Prince didn't care. To take the statement further, he began performing with the word slave written on his cheek, making no secret at all of his feelings of being a pawn used to make money for Warner Brothers while they owned everything he turned out, everything he recorded, everything he released, every note he played, every album in his catalog, every single, every B-side, everything he was. They owned it. He wanted ownership of it. They weren't going to give it up. Remember what I said about when the label pulls the string, he has to dance? That's how he felt. He wrote the word slave on his cheek. He changed his name to a symbol, a picture that nobody could pronounce. And then he went out there and kept doing his thing and said to everybody else, you figure it out. Said to the label, you figure it out. MTV, if you want to play my shit, you figure it out. Radio. You don't even have a video component. Radio, all you're hearing is a person's voice, just like you're listening to me right now. I can't put a picture up that you can see. I can't even show you the love symbol. I can describe it for you, but I can't show you what the thing looks like. Radio couldn't even do that. MTV could, you know, or like if Inside Edition or somebody did a story on him in the evening, or if like one of the late night shows wanted to rip him or make fun of his ass for doing this thing that they all thought was stupid, they could show the symbol. Radio couldn't do that. He says, you guys figure it out. And so I was talking about the New Power Generation a moment ago, and I talked about the first two albums they put out. And I said, hold that thought. I'll get right back to that before I took you back to tell you about Prince changing his name and all this stuff. So now we're going to return to 96 when the New Power Generation broke up. Prince obviously was going to keep that band going. He thought the New Power Generation really represented the direction that he wanted to go in. And whether or not it had the original members, whether or not it had the classic lineup, he was going to keep hiring people who, to him, represented what that band was. And he was going to keep them rolling. And as I said, they were going to be right behind him until he died. So if you look today at a list of former members of the New Power Generation, for God's sake, there's nearly 30 names on that list. So by 1998, version 2.0 of the New Power Generation debuts on 1998's New Power Soul album. The cover of the album is Prince holding a microphone in the shape of a gun. His finger is resting on the trigger, a little threatening. And if the metaphor in this album cover was of his music as a weapon, that would turn out to be exactly how he fought his way out of the 90s. We'll be right back.
Full episodes at 6, noon, and 8. WNUT.
You are listening to WNUT Talk, talking about the time that Prince went nuts and decided he didn't need a name anymore. At least not one you could say. And he didn't give a goddamn. He was going to let you figure it out. So we talked about witnessing Prince breaking up with the record label system, so to speak. You know, he's out there with slave written on his cheek. He's got a name that you can't say anymore because it's a damn picture that somebody drew. And this was decades before Taylor Swift took back her music and her catalog with the Taylor's versions and made all the labels' masters useless. Prince launched an offensive that would eventually see Warner Brothers grant him control of every note he'd ever recorded for them. And this was long before we became aware of what things like that meant because of fights like hers. When I say this story consumed popular culture and MTV and the tabloids and late night TV and radio, I'm kind of putting it mildly. And no one could make any sense of this. I remember vividly, like everyone wondered, had he lost his damn mind? And asked the question right out loud. You got to think this is a time right around, I mean, at the same time that Prince is this unnamed symbol, we're watching Michael Jackson kind of melt down in front of us on national television. Every time he popped up on TV, his appearance had changed a bit. You know, he's got all these accusations swirling. It looks to us like some of the gods among our celebrities are falling, you know, maybe falling from grace or just sort of metaphorically tripping and falling in front of us. It was a bizarre time. So, Yeah, there were a lot of jokes. There was a lot of judgment. There was a lot of stuff like that. We had not seen kind of, you know, some of the public difficulties, I'll say, that artists would continue to go through, like Britney Spears and Kesha and stuff like that. And I know full well what Prince was doing was not on par with some of that stuff. He had a very, this was kind of a strategic attack that he was launching towards Warner Brothers and his record label, and a point he was trying to make. But I also want you to understand that back then, we had no fucking idea. I mean, it looked like it could be just a mental health crisis that he was going through. There was a lot of speculation. Nobody really knew. WNUT even did a bit on episode 7 in 1994 where we asked a contest caller to tell us Prince's name. And when the phone line was silent for several seconds, I shouted, "Yes, that's absolutely correct. You know, what's Prince's name?" They fucking say nothing, and they're right. So most journalists and media took to calling him the artist formerly known as Prince, which is a goddamn mouthful. I mean, it was unwieldy, it was wordy, and, you know, he probably didn't like it very much. But God, what else could anyone do? One more album would have Prince's name on the cover. 1994's Come, which included the dates 1958 to 1993 underneath his name. The year Prince Rogers Nelson was born, and the year the name Prince symbolically died. It was an underwhelming album. It kind of represented what was left of a project called Glam Slam Ulysses, which was sort of this, I don't know, multimedia project idea that he had that kind of retold the story of Homer's Odyssey. And the better songs from that project would find their way onto other releases in the coming years. Otherwise, there were two exceptions. An album from The Vault, just referred to as the Black Album, would come out in 1994, and it was a project that he had meant to release in 1987, but at the last minute, Prince had decided to shelve that album in favor of the Love Sexy album, which came out, and then the Black Album was bootlegged and bootlegged and bootlegged. Prince and or Warner Brothers, I don't know if it was one or the other or the combo of both, decided to put an official version out there to cut off the bootleggers at the knees. They finally released this thing, you know, referred to as the Black Album because it is completely black cover, black everything. There is no album title. There is no artist name. But there was a hype sticker on that release that said Prince. The name was printed on the sticker. And the sticker also said the Legendary Black Album, limited edition. That was it. It went quickly out of print. Also, the 1999 collection called The Vault, Old Friends for Sale, which was a collection of older material. Kind of like, I mean, the Black Album was at least an album from The Vault. This was just a collection of tracks that never saw their way onto anything. And he kind of, you know, gave it to Warner Brothers and they released it to fulfill his contract once and for all. That came out in 99. That one had Prince's name on the cover, and that was it. So what of the music that Prince released as the unpronounceable symbol? Was it any good? The ultimate question, and the one that people talk about the least, what was the music like that he released in this phase of his career? Let's dive into it. After Come came and went, I actually think Prince got down to real business and released some of the best music of his career. No exaggeration. I think he was put on this earth to release some of the music that he did in the 90s. I think it stands eye to eye with anything he had done throughout the 80s. 1995's The Gold Experience was an incredible album. It was the last with the original New Power Generation lineup. And damn, I love that album. It was out of print for a long, long time. They finally reissued it in the years following his death. And I have been preaching the gospel to anyone who will listen. If you haven't heard The Gold Experience, do yourself a favor. Dolphin and Endorphin Machine are two tracks from the Glam Slam Ulysses project that wound up on that one, as well as not from Glam Slam Ulysses, but there was one called P Control, that short for Pussy Control. I guess they didn't want to print it. Amazing song. I mean, don't judge it by the name. It's so good, and it's so Prince. And the Unstoppable Groove 319, it's such a good, just the whole album. I love it. I love it so much. To me, it's a great follow-up to the Love Symbol album from 1992. You just have to pretend that Come in 1994 never happened. In 1996, there was an album called Chaos and Disorder. That's basically another Vault album. More than a third of that album was left over from the Gold Experience. Critics were not kind to it when it came out. After Prince died, they were much kinder to that particular collection of songs. He kind of unleashes his inner Jimi Hendrix on that album. There's a slew of guitar-driven songs, which apparently underwhelmed Warner Brothers at the time. I shit you not. I found this quote when I was looking up that album today, and it floored me that a record label exec would say this. Senior Vice President of Publicity Bob Merlis at Warner Brothers said, quote, "We've come to a point where we feel that if he's happier somewhere else, we don't have any beef with him," unquote. God damn. He put out Chaos and Disorder, and about that release, their fucking senior publicity guy says that? That is some shit I couldn't have imagined that. You couldn't have convinced me in a million years that somebody would say that about not only an artist signed to their label, but somebody who's made them as much money as Prince made Warner Brothers in 18 years at that point. It's insane. Anyway, his first album outside of the Warner Brothers deal was 1996's Emancipation. That came out on his own NPG Records. Yes, New Power Generation, NPG Records. Emancipation had three discs, was 3 hours long, and had 36 tracks, 12 tracks per disc. He was covering other artists for the first time, which was something that Warner Brothers had always discouraged him from doing. The album was a lot. When it came out, I remember avoiding it for a while just because, God, that seemed like an insurmountable amount of Prince music. It was a mountain of shit to hear, and I wasn't up to the task. But this was the sound of Prince taking off the chains that he had felt bound by for so long. This was the moment he had waited for. This was him walking outside and finally just shouting from the rooftop that he was free and doing what he wanted to do, and making the album that he wanted to make. And you'll understand the difficulty that fans had approaching the new Prince, or the symbol that he was at the time, when I tell you that the next thing he put out was January 1998's Crystal Ball. Originally, you could only order the thing over the phone or the internet. And let me tell you, ordering something online was revolutionary for 1997. Most of us didn't even know how to do it. So Prince was a trailblazer there. Now, Crystal Ball was another three-disc album. Actually had four. There was a fourth disc, which was an acoustic album called The Truth. Some people consider it, you know, a new Prince album for that year. Some people just consider it kind of a bonus disc of acoustic material that he put. With Crystal Ball, I don't know where I stand on it. I mean, I never put it on as a Prince album and listened to it. It's not that kind of a thing to me. But hey, Crystal Ball was actually just a release of three discs of Vault material. It wasn't released on the Warner Brothers contract, but it was him putting out a Vault release on his own NPG Records. It was material that went back to 1983. It was shit that Prince lovers and people who just lived for his music had wanted to hear for a long time and absolutely ate it up. But for the public to look at that and see another like 3-4 disc album coming out after he just gave us Emancipation 2 years before. Yeah, the public was they could be excused for thinking that the new Prince was just flooding him with too much too quickly. And if this was going to be his new format, maybe Warner Brothers was right. I don't think so. I understand kind of what he was doing here. Look, he had a lot to get off his chest, and this was his moment. And it kind of never happened like this again. So you sort of have to look at it in context and just nod your head. We've discussed the Vault Old Friends for Sale that came out in 1999. That's the one that fulfilled his Warner Brothers contract. That leaves 1999's actual new Prince album, an album called Rave Unto the Joy Fantastic. And this was his return to pop. He had guest appearances on there from Gwen Stefani, Eve, Sheryl Crow, even Chuck D from Public Enemy. And radio was a little friendlier with this album than it had been with Emancipation and some of the stuff around the mid-90s. And then in 2000, the Warner Brothers deal was over. He'd given them all the albums that they needed to satisfy that deal. And he kind of quietly reverts back to the name Prince. quietly, at least in comparison to the noise it made when he became a fucking unpronounceable symbol. I mean, when you think about it, he'd spent 15 years as Prince already. Where was the story there? They weren't going to talk about that as much as they were going to talk about what looked like a man losing his mind in front of all our very eyes. So, yeah, 2001 saw the release of The Rainbow Children, which was kind of a funk, soul, jazz fusion record that the world might not have been ready for, but it was the first one since 1994, rightly and properly, under the name Prince. And that's the way it would remain until ultimately he was gone in 2016. And ironically, in the after Warner Brothers years, it may be the albums with major label support behind them, like Columbia's Musicology and Universal's 3121, that got the most public support and response, going platinum and gold respectively. Prince would even try doing the big box retailer exclusive thing in 2009 when he put out Lotus Flower exclusively at Target stores. And then he ultimately returned to Warner Brothers for Plectrum Electrum and Artificial Age in 2014, 2 years before he died. But let me tell you, you can take my Prince CDs from Diamonds and Pearls through Emancipation from my cold dead hands, because those years were a new kind of magic being born up at Paisley Park. And I'm not saying they're perfect. I've often said I could take the three Emancipation discs and whittle them down to one disc that the world, probably at large, would agree was essential in the Prince canon. Doesn't mean I want to throw out the other two discs worth. It just means he could have made some moves differently. But who the hell couldn't? Hey, if the artist formerly known as Prince had a name, what would it be, and would you call it to his face if you were faced with him and all his glory? I'm Brandon. This has been WNUT Talk. Listen to WNUT on the Live 365 network. Just download the free Live 365 app or search WNUT on live365.com. And hey, also check us out on YouTube at The Real WNUT. We've got full shows of the flagship WNUT program going all the way back to the 90s, as well as episodes of WJAZ with the Jazz Man and WNUT After Dark with my usual cohort, the Great Fishniz, aka Carl. That's going to do it for me. I got some video games calling my name, so right now I'm going to go party like it's 1999. I will see you next time right here on WNUT Talk.